Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, listeners. This episode is sponsored by Luke's English Podcast Premium. I've got a brand new premium series coming very soon. I've been working very hard on it, and it's going to be quite a long series. It's all about homophones. Homophones are words that sound exactly the same, but they're spelt differently and they have different meanings. And you must be aware of the different homophones in English. They cause lots of problems. They cause confusion. They cause people to say they don't say the wrong word because it sounds like another word. So it makes people spell words wrong. And also, homophones are often the basis of many, many jokes too. So anyway, in this new premium series, I'll be going through loads of very common and very important homophones and also giving you lots of jokes as well. So it will be good for your vocab, good for your spelling, good for your pronunciation. So check it out. It'll be available very soon. So there you go. That's going to be premium series. Is it premium series 24 now? And it'll be, oh God, a few episodes in that series. Anyway, sign up to Luke's English Podcast Premium if you want to access all of that extra content. There are videos, there are audio episodes, and also PDFs as well, with tests and pronunciation drills. How do you get that, Luke? Well, you just go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. That's where you'll get all the details, and that's where you can sign up as well. Okay, there will be a premium series arriving on Sunday if everything goes according to plan, unless, you know, I get stuck in some airport departure lounge, or I get stuck on a train, or God knows, or if there's a huge earthquake and a massive gap is created between me and a microphone. It's unlikely, isn't it? Let's be honest. But anyway, if all goes according to plan, this new premium series will arrive on Sunday, and it will give you stuff to listen to over the next period of time. Stop it, Luke, now. That's enough. Just get to the episode. Okay, thanks for listening to this little bit at the beginning. I'm now going to waffle on a bit more after the jingle, which is going to start right now. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello there, and welcome to this new episode of Luke's English Podcast. How are you today? Hope you're doing all right. I'm okay, thanks. In fact, I'm very happy to present this episode to you. This one was a bit of a treat for me, and I hope it will be for you as well, because in this conversation, I'm talking to David Crystal again for the second time on Luke's English Podcast. The first time was, what was it, episode 454 and 455? I think so. So a couple of hundred episodes ago now. Anyway, David Crystal is back. Now, do you know who David Crystal is? Many of you at this point will be going, yes, of course we do. It's the amazing David Crystal. Some of you won't know who he is, and I feel like I should tell you a couple of things about him just so that you know who you'll be listening to. So essentially, David Crystal is one of the world's leading linguists. He's an expert on language, the English language especially. And, what can I say about him? He's written over 100 books on various aspects of language, grammar, vocabulary, pronunciation, accents, the history of English, the development of language in children, and many, many other topics. So he's a linguist. He's not an English teacher. He's a linguist, so that means that he's an expert in, let's say, the science of language, studying what language is, how it works, how we all use it. And he's back on the podcast this time mainly because he's written a new book, which is now available. The book is called Let's Talk, How English Conversation Works. And as the name of the book suggests, it is an exploration of the subject of conversations. What are conversations? How do they work? And a lot of it's about the pragmatics of conversations. A lot of it involves busting certain myths that we have about the way conversations work. Let me see. What does the Oxford University Press website say about the book? It says this is an entertaining and accessible introduction to English conversation. It includes a wide range of examples drawn from classic literature, TV, politics, and actual samples of authentic conversations. The book dispels some common misconceptions about how conversation works, while also providing interesting and insightful comments about both the history and future of our conversations. So, in this conversation about conversations that you're going to listen to, we dip into various themes relating to the topic of conversations and many other things too, including whether he ever gets irritated by the way people use language, the way we have to communicate on platforms now like Zoom, because Zoom and, you know, Skype and all the different video conferencing technology that we use now, how is that affecting the way that we have our conversations? We talk about conversations across different cultures, talking to animals, whether or not it's actually possible to have a conversation with an animal, and also things like how to write well, because as David is a prolific author and he writes very successfully, he's got a couple of little bits of advice on writing well. Also, I had to ask him about the place of humour and jokes in language because I'm slightly obsessed with the subject. And also, as I often use humour and jokes in my English language teaching, I felt compelled to ask him about that just to sort of check, basically. Is this a good idea, you know, using jokes and humour in my lessons? I think it is, but anyway, I wanted him to talk about it. Shut up, Luke, you're talking too much now. Just get to the interview. Okay. Lots of other things, raising bilingual kids, and also details of another book that he's written. So this interview was set up in order to talk about Let's Talk, this book about conversations. And then in our email correspondence, David mentioned that he'd written another book. So since writing this one, this new one, another new one is out, and that's interesting. It's a sort of a spy thriller. A work of semi-fiction. It's like partly fictional, partly based on fact. And it's a spy story, which is called The Encyclopedia Codes. And it's really interesting sounding. So he talks about that a little bit. Anyway, that's enough from me now. Let's get into this conversation about conversations. I'll talk to you again at the end. And I'll, you know, mention some other details that I think you should know. But anyway, let's listen to David Crystal talking about conversations, and here we go.
Hello, we're talking about language.
Sit down, let's have a chat.
A bit of a chat, sir.
A bit of a chat, yes, Roger, just a bit of a chat.
What about, sir?
About English as a global language.
This is a conversation.
Yes.
I would like to talk to you.
Okay, let's talk. Let's have a quick conversation, huh? What do you think?
That's what we're going to do.
Away, baby, let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a conversation
about language.
Right. David, it's lovely to talk to you. It's an absolute pleasure, actually. A real treat.
Yeah, delighted to be back with you, Luke.
Yeah. So how's the lockdown been for you? This is something I've been asking my guests, obviously, in recent months. How's the lockdown treated you?
Well, actually, not that very much differently from pre-lockdown and I hope post-lockdown. You know, I spend most of my life writing books and it's a lonely profession. You sit in front of your computer like I'm doing now and you write away and hope for the best. And then, so I've been just carrying on doing that sort of thing.
Mm.
The big difference, of course, is no travel. And I do an awful lot of talks in schools, to literary festivals, especially when a book comes out, but generally. And that's all gone, or at least not gone so much as replaced by online occasionally. So I've been quite busy with new online stuff and learned an awful lot about Zoom conversations, for instance, that I didn't know before. Yeah. But otherwise, we've had a fairly placid lockdown here in Wales. The virus hasn't been as horrible as it has in some other places. Mm. So, and we've been lucky, and our son is home living with us, and he's been doing all the shopping. You know, the domestic side has been lovely.
That's good. That's good. But so that your new book, which was published earlier this month, is called Let's Talk: How English Conversation Works. So, what have you discovered then? How do conversations work? It's a huge question. You've written a whole book on it, but I'm kind of wondering where we can start. But how do they work?
Well, there are two sides to this. One is that when drawing people's attention to the things that they do every day and they don't realize what the rules are underneath those things. So you take an absolutely everyday thing like a greeting, saying hello or saying good morning or saying goodbye and saying good night. Mm. And you say, you know, I'm going to teach these to students or just tell people about them. What's the difference? And they say, well, there is no difference. You say good morning in the morning. You say good night at night time. That's the end of it. But when you actually analyze the difference, you find that there are some very subtle but very important distinctions. For example, you say good morning to somebody only once. If I meet you in the corridor, Luke, I say, morning, Luke. You say, morning, David. 5 minutes later, I see you again. I don't say, morning, Luke, a second time. That would feel very, very odd. Mm. And indeed, if I said it inadvertently, I might apologize and say, oh, sorry, Luke, I've said good morning to you already, haven't I? But at night time, if I'm leaving you and I leave your office and say, good night, Luke, and you say good night, or I forget something, I go back in and I pick it up. I say, good night, Luke, good night.
Yeah, good night.
Good night. Good night. Good night. I can say it 10 times. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But it's the same with hello and goodbye. Now, most people, because I checked this out when I was lecturing on the subject, I'd say to people, do you know what the difference is in terms of good morning and good night? Nobody knows. I mean, they know instinctively, but they don't know intellectually.
Yeah.
So that's one kind of finding that I tried to present. The other kind is to knock down some of the myths about conversation that are very widespread. What are some examples? Well, interruptions. You know, interruptions get a very bad press.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody listening to this or watching this types interruptions into Google or somewhere, up come the style guides, which will say things like, you should never interrupt. Interrupt is bad. It's impolite. It's terrible. Avoid it at all costs. Well, of course, there are some circumstances where to interrupt would be impolite. If you're having a very serious conversation and it's on a very formal subject matter and you're in full flow, then an interruption is likely to be considered poor form. But in the kind of informal, domestic, everyday interactions that I was analysing, interruptions are all the time. People are always chipping in, and they're chipping in for positive reasons. They're saying, oh, yeah, because what you just said, I remember I had an example exactly like that. Go on.
Yeah.
And people respond positively to this and say, as it were, say in their minds, thank you very much for that interruption. It's helped me actually shape what I was saying and perhaps even prompt me to go off in a new direction, which I hadn't thought of before. So almost all the interruptions that I found in the data, and there were hundreds of them, almost all of them, well, I think there's just one or two where somebody got a bit sniffy. Almost all of them were positive things. They helped the conversation to flow along, and people responded very positively to them. So that's the kind of thing I mean when I say, you know, you're breaking down a myth.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. There are lots and lots of sort of kind of like moments where you've pull back the curtain on conversations and kind of like show us what is really going on. Do you find that people, I think I probably asked you this last time, but it's always something that strikes me whenever I read your work, is that sense that, let's say, lay people or people who aren't linguists do get very passionate about language, and that people are very opinionated about it. I mean, do you never take an opinion on language? Does nothing ever kind of trigger you in terms of the way people use language? Does nothing ever irritate you? Because, for example, if I talk to my family, as I was this weekend, the subject of language always comes up, and it's usually someone complaining about how, you know, people do this, people say that, and it annoys them.
It's always a complaint, isn't it? It's never a prick.
That's true.
Always a complaint.
Yeah. Lots of complaints. I mean, I may give you an example later on. But anyway, I'm curious to see if, do you ever get bothered by the way people use language?
Yes. I mean, I'm human as well as being a linguist.
Yeah.
So I've got my likes and dislikes. The difference between being a linguist and being a pedant, as it were, is that pedants try to make the rest of the world speak like them or share their attitudes. Whereas linguists, whether they like the usage that they've observed or dislike it, they're not in the business of going out and saying, well, you should like it as well, or you should dislike it as well. That's right. The difference between descriptivism and a prescriptive approach to things. So in that sense, no, I've never been bothered about another usage which I don't share. Mm-hmm. Or I might even dislike. But what I want to do as a linguist is explain it, try and work out why there is this difference. Where does it come from? Is it a regional thing? Is it a social thing? What is going on? There's only one occasion, one type of occasion, when dislike as a human being influences the way in which I would operate as a linguist. And it's this: when people who are professionals in language lose their professionalism and don't use the language in the way that they should be doing, having been trained supposedly to do it right. Now, an example: you're in a railway station or a ferry boat. And actually, I'll take the ferry boat example because I'll tell you why in a minute. Mm-hmm. And you're hearing the safety instructions being read out, and they're being read so fast that you can't understand them. The guy has read it 1,000 times. So it's, and you think, well, sorry, hold on, slow down, will you? Slow down, these are important. And when somebody is professionally using language in the public domain and you can't understand it, because of some casualness or carelessness or whatever you like about the language, then this is where the human being and the linguist come together. You've got to say to these people, look, you're using language wrongly in terms of the audience for which the language is intended.
Yeah.
And I choose the ferry example because Stena ferries many years ago were getting so many complaints about the use of announcements, so they actually employed me for a week to go in and train the announcers. And the interesting thing was this, Luke, that the complaints largely said, I can't understand the announcement because of the regional accent that the speaker has got. And it's true that there were people giving the speech from Liverpool and from Poland and all over the place. But that wasn't the reason at all. It was simply that they were speaking too fast. That was the only reason. Right. When they slowed down and took breaths and paced themselves, the fact that there was a regional accent was neither here nor there. Poor old regional accents, they get penalized for all sorts of things that actually are nothing to do with them at all. So that's the main category. And, you know, you can generalize it. It's not just public announcements. People often react in this way to announcers on the radio who forget themselves for a moment and say things like, that was Symphony Number 3 by...
Mm-hmm.
And you think, sorry, by who? By who? By who? And the composer is lost because for whatever reason, the announcer has turned away from the microphone or they've lowered their voice too much.
Yeah.
So that's another example of professionalism gone wrong.
I see. Going back to the subjects of conversations again, what about this conversation that we're having now? Is this a normal conversation?
No, it isn't. And this is a big thing. I have a chapter on this in the book, but it was a chapter that was written before BZ, as it were, before Zoom. The thing is, most people now over the last few months have had many Zoom conversations. And at the end, they feel tired.
Yeah.
You know, especially if it's gone on a while. Now, why? And it's because it's not a normal conversation. So, first question, what are the features that make a conversation normal and successful? And the primary one, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is that there is a thing called simultaneous feedback. Now, simultaneous feedback is when you're talking to somebody and the other person, your listener, isn't staying quiet. They're saying things like, and so on. That is critical to the success of a face-to-face conversation.
It's in this conversation, even then, interrupting is difficult on Zoom. I try, you know, if I want to chip in with something, it sort of can break things up, and it's like, oh, stop, jip, jip, like that. And also the technology sometimes, if I make a noise, and I'm recording the audio for this, obviously, if I make a noise, it can cut out your voice. So if just me going, means that suddenly three words of yours have been lost.
That's exactly right. And also there's the phenomenon of lag. So that depending on where we are and how the technology is doing, your might appear a couple of seconds later, by which time I've done another 10 or 15 syllables and I'm getting a positive reaction or a negative one to something that I said so long ago, and this can be very off-putting. So on the whole, once people learn about Zoom, and also, by the way, in radio broadcasts where a good interviewer will not be going all the time, people learn to shut up. And as soon as they do that, then your poor speaker is suddenly on his or her own. So I'm now speaking to you, and I've no idea while I'm speaking whether you're agreeing with what I'm saying or disagreeing with it, whether you've got a... If I were face-to-face with you, I'd see from your face maybe a gesture and of course, the occasional noise that you're giving me feedback. You're saying, yeah, that's good, David. Keep going. Or you're saying, oh, hang on a minute, David. Hang on a second. Now, I will pick up on that and either alter my behavior, alter my conversation, or stop and ask you what the question problem is or whatever it might be. Now, none of that is there routinely on Zoom. So you are on or in any of these media interactions. So you're on your own. Yeah. You're always on, as they say. And as a result, and this is quite tiring, so that if you're having this kind of conversation and it goes on for longer than, you know, half an hour, perhaps, maybe less for some people, more for others, after a while you're thinking, gosh, how am I doing? Oh, dear. I mean, is this conversation ever going to end? and it really is very tricky. And the more people there are, the worse it gets. So if you're in gallery view, for instance, on Zoom,
yeah,
and you're talking to a group, as I did the other day with a group of school children in a school somewhere, and there were 15 faces in front of me. Now it's worse because I can't look at them all. I can't interact with them all. I have no idea whether they are enjoying what they're hearing. Their faces are basically blank or distracted. You know, somebody is in their house and they disappear suddenly and go off for a cup of tea or something like this, which doesn't happen in a normal classroom. You know, normally. So a group situation is even more difficult to stage manage as a speaker than a one-to-one.
Yeah.
So for all these reasons, an online interaction is somewhat artificial, even though some of us are getting quite competent at handling it.
Yeah. There, in Zoom, there are reactions. I suppose you've explored all these things, but you do have the option to give a reaction. So if I do this now, I'm going to put it on gallery view, which the recording should show. If I can give a thumbs up or an applause emoji. So if I give the thumbs up, you end up with that. But I did that in conversation with my brother, I think, recently on Zoom while recording a podcast, and I gave him a thumbs up, and he was like, "What's that massive hand?" So it's not quite as smooth as normal interactions.
No, it's tricky because there are all kinds of interferences. I mean, you might leave it up for too long. So the point where you were approving, and I then make another point for which you disapprove or want to, you know, distinguish it, and the thumbs up is still there. You've got, in other words, it's like playing the piano almost. You've got to be able to handle all these technological things. I imagine there are virtuosi Zoomists out there, but most of us don't have that kind of facility. So anything artificial like that is could be a good feature, but it's tricky to use them well.
I have many things to ask you, David. So conversations in English versus conversations in different cultures. Have you ever had any difficult moments during conversations with people from other cultures?
Yeah, all the time. And this also warrants a chapter in the book, but it could be a whole book, actually. Mm. And I hope somebody will write a whole book. And by cultural differences, I don't just mean regional cultural differences. I mean cultural differences because of age, because of gender, because of ethnicity, as well as because of region. Mm. And sometimes, of course, all these things come together in one place or another. So I give a couple of examples in the book, but really it's a whole new book to write. So, for example, the use of silence varies enormously, doesn't it, from one part of the world to the other. Some people, some cultures revel in silence. It's a positive thing. In a British culture, silence is somewhat awkward. If there's a silence in a conversation, people want to fill it. And so they will say as quickly as possible something to get so that the silence doesn't last for too long. In some other parts of the world, if there's a silence, it means nobody has anything to say. So that's fine. Let's just stay silent until somebody thinks of something to say. Now, it takes a lot of getting used to. I had real trouble with this when I first went to Japan, for instance.
Yeah, me too.
Japanese, very good example of a culture that values silence and reflectiveness in a way that, you know, I just don't see very often over here. And the very first time that I encountered this, I did not know what to do. You know, I felt, had I said something wrong? Why has everybody suddenly gone silent? I'd made a point. And then I sort of intervened with myself and people sort of ignored it. And gradually I learned, of course. And as a linguist, I was able to talk about this to other colleagues in Japan. And they told me, you see. And so I learn from people who have analyzed the situation in that country. So there's that. And then there's, of course, the topic of content. What should you talk about? What should you not talk about in a particular culture?
Yeah.
There are conventions everywhere. The weather is usually a fairly safe topic for most places. I don't know whether there's any culture in the world which doesn't talk about the weather. At some point there might be. I don't know. I've never had a trouble with that. But I remember one example where we had some foreign students come to the house. Mm. And what do you do when you go to somebody's house? You compliment the host, don't you, on whatever it is, on the decor or something like that.
Yeah.
But you don't ask what they cost. But in this part of the world, and I can't remember now, honestly can't remember which it was, it is a matter of praise to ask the person how much something cost, because when you give the response, it shows, you know, class and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
I'm doing very well, you know.
And status.
It's a status thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so I looked over the curtains and said, you know, so how much did these curtains cost? Sorry, I don't know.
Meaning these are very fine curtains. They must be very expensive.
Yeah, very fine curtains indeed, not how much do they cost.
Right.
So, you know, there are things like that which you get used to or you have to learn.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there are some books around which I always try to read before going to a country. which say, you know, discover our country, and they will tell you some of the things you should do and some of the things you shouldn't do. They're invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What about men and women? Do men and women do conversations differently? Because apparently men are from Mars and women are from Venus, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I give that rather short shrift in the book. I have a few paragraphs on it. The basic answer is no. There might be a few. You know, the tradition has been, and when conversations were first being analysed, there was this view that, oh, for instance, you know, men interrupt more than women do and things like that. But as time has gone by, we've realised that this is just a huge oversimplification. Mm. There are so many factors involved, the subject matter, the context, the type of audience, all sorts of things. And to try and reduce these to a simple gender opposition is just absurd.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's good to recognize that there are some trends which can affect some people of a different gender. You know, certain words that might turn up rather more frequently in one gender rather than the other. But as soon as you try to make these into anything hard and fast, like a Mars-Venus situation, breaks down very, very quickly. And that's sort of the message I convey in the book. Yeah. It's not my message. It's a message that I've derived from all the people who have specialized in gender studies over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah. What about talking to animals? Is it possible to have a conversation with an animal?
Most certainly is. Uh-huh. I have a section in the book called, what was it called now? Does it take two to make a conversation? And the answer is yes, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the other party in the conversation is going to reply to you in the way that a human being would. And there are lots of examples. Animals are one thing. Anybody who owns a dog or a cat or whatever it might be knows very well that if you have a conversation, that the dog sort of is listening and will react in some ways, and you interpret those responses and as if it were human. Yeah. The classic example, of course, is talking to your plants. Mm. Any plant owner that I've ever encountered, and we have one in this house, talks regularly to their plants, and the plant just smiles back, and that doesn't seem to make any difference. The conversation continues. And I did read a piece of scientific research once which showed that because the carbon dioxide coming out of the mouth is going to the plant, it's actually helping the plant grow.
Yeah, that's what I understood, that actually talking to your plants is good for the plants because exactly, you kind of breathe carbon dioxide onto them and they like it.
Yeah, apparently. But, you know, there are lots of situations. And, of course, the ultimate case, you talk to yourself.
Mm.
So I go into the broom cupboard and stand on a broom and it comes up and hits me here and I have a conversation with the broom. It's not a very polite conversation, but I tell it off and I give it a good telling off. And then the other thing, I've asked lots of people, do you have a conversation in your head about whatever? So you're going to an interview or something like this. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of think through the kinds of questions and answers you might get. Or you're just reporting to somebody a conversation you had the other day. I'm going to tell Jane all about this, about the conversation I just had with Fred. And in your head is going through, you're going through this conversation. You actually sort of think it through before actually speaking it out later, if you ever do speak it out at all.
Yeah.
And everybody thinks, oh, it's just me. Well, it turns out that it isn't just me. I don't know whether everybody does this, but everybody I've asked has admitted to doing it sometimes.
Yeah, I talk out loud to myself all the time. I'm not shy about admitting it because it's one of those things, one of those bits of advice that English teachers like to give to their students, which is, you know, speak out loud in English and there's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't mean you're crazy or anything. It's totally fine to kind of just, you know, waffle away in English to yourself. But I do it all the time. I actually really enjoy it. And it's fun to talk in different accents and things in different situations. It's a lot of fun. So
things you wouldn't dare do, perhaps, in a dialogue situation.
Yes. Yes,
that
exactly.
Might happen too.
I mean, weirdly, talking on a podcast is pretty odd when it's just me on my own. Because essentially I'm just in a room on my own and I have to imagine that there are people out there listening to it, you know. And
well, this is like radio broadcasting. I used to do a lot of radio broadcasting. When I first did it, I asked the producer, you know, how do I do this? And I got some wonderful advice from some of these very experienced radio producers. And they said, David, you're in a room talking to your wife, your husband, your friend, your mother, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's who you're talking to. Shut your eyes and you're just talking to her or him.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. That's all you need to know. Of course, you're reading a script or whatever, but that's all you're talking to. You're in a sitting room somewhere. That's it. And that's what one has to do, I think.
Yeah.
And interestingly, when you're writing a book, at least this is what I try to do, I try to imagine the same thing. I never send a book to press without having read it aloud to myself to make sure it flows smoothly. And if it doesn't, there's something wrong with the writing. But in any case, you know, just like now, you're asking me a question, I'm giving you the response. I could, if I had the book here, open it up and read the response to the question, assuming it's been in the book. And I would hope that the way in which I would read the response would be not too different, colloquialisms aside, you know, and informality aside, from the way I'm talking to you now.
That's very interesting, because your writing does definitely come across like that. It's very, very readable. It's not sort of overly complex. It's really, really pleasant to read. But that's
thank you. Because that is very much what I've tried to do my entire life. And this isn't just a matter of gift, incidentally, though that must play a part in it. It's also a matter of linguistics. Because when you study the language of informal conversation, or the language of anything, you realize that there are certain types of structure which are going to cause complications to a listener or to a reader, which to avoid would be a very good thing. Now, what sort of thing do I mean? Well, the fact that if you're writing, and certainly when you're speaking, if you do an analysis of hours and hours and hours, you find that on the whole, subjects are short before the verb, and the length of a sentence is concentrated after the verb. So most of the time when we're talking to each other, and this is especially the case in conversation, the sentence or the clause begins, so I verb did something or other, or my friend verb did something or other.
Yeah.
And the length is after the verb. Now, if you do it the other way around, if you put the length of a sentence before the verb, it immediately gets difficult to understand, or more difficult to process, as it were, and it's more difficult to read. So, for example, and there are, of course, some very famous politicians who do this kind of thing all the time, much to our irritation. So, here we go. Are you ready?
Yeah.
My friends, the party that I belong to now, the party that I've been with for many, many years, the party that I love deeply, and one which I think is a party that you and all you listening to me now will value more. And you're thinking, come on, get on with it. What's this about? Get to the verb, please. I need a verb.
Yeah.
That kind of long thing is disturbing, and not only in speech, but in writing too. Now, in terms of language learning, language teaching, go to a textbook teaching people about reading, early readers, and ask the question, if it's an early reader and the language is to be as easy as possible to process, then you would expect the sentences to have a short subject before the verb. Go look, because what you find is that in an awful lot of cases, the subject is quite long. So, the big bad wolf with the awful teeth went.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, that's already longer than an average 5-6-year-old is going to be able to process. The poor kid is already trying to decode the written language, having difficulty there. And now on top of that, you're giving him a long grammatical subject. It's going to get heavy in there. And you can actually test this out. We're in psycholinguistics now.
Yeah.
You test this out and show that comprehension is not so good when the sentence subjects get long.
So don't front load the sentences.
That's a perfect way of expressing it. Don't front load the sentences for early learners, or I guess the same thing would apply to early adult learners as well. You know, keep the sentences as natural as possible by keeping the subjects short.
How on earth are you so prolific, David? You've written so many books. You just keep coming out with them. What's the secret?
Well, the secret is to marry somebody who is a wonderful partner, and I have got that, and who is also a writer. That helps enormously. No, it's very true. There's no secret. First of all, you have to have the time, and to have the time, you have to have a job that allows you to have that time. When I was full-time at the university, back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, I did manage to get a few books out in the summer vacations and things like that. But not really. The job was just too complicated, as it still is, of course. You know, all the admin, all the bureaucracy, all the teaching you have to do, all those things. If you're a researcher and a writer, then it's not that they get in the way, because they actually fuel what it is you're going to be writing about, but they don't give you very much time. So I left the full-time university world in 1984 and became independent for that very reason. I discovered that, well, it wasn't a discovery. I knew that ever since a teenager that what I wanted to be was a writer. I started writing when I was in my teens, in fiction, as it happens. And I always wanted to be a full-time writer, and therefore, by implication, lecturer and broadcaster and what have you. But the writing was the thing. It's all I ever wanted to do. And the university world was getting in the way of it. So I left it. I mean, you know, fingers crossed, is it going to work? No salary suddenly. It was a tricky moment, but it worked out well. And most of the books that you're hinting at in your question have been written since that time.
Okay. So we've been talking about Let's Talk, How English Conversation Works, which is the new book. But in our emails, you told me that actually there's another book. You've come out with another one as well. Since writing this one, during the lockdown, I think you wrote another one.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Lockdown does strange things to people, doesn't it? I mean, what it did for me, you see, was because I was no longer taking, see, last year I did 200 days out of the house, traveling around the country and around the world, doing talks and things. Suddenly, all those talks have disappeared. So how do you fill that time? Well, if you're a writer, you write. Now, I'd actually got a draft of something that I had a go at a while back, which I brought to fruition during lockdown. And to see the context for this, before I explain what it is, that I had an ambition as a teenager, which I developed earlier on. And this was, I would love to write, make a contribution to, not necessarily to publish, but to write in every genre.
Yeah.
And academically, of course, the genres are, as we all know, you know, articles, reviews, essays, textbooks, course books, things like that. But in literature as well. I wanted to write short stories. I wanted to write plays. I wanted to write poems. I wanted to write novels and so on. And I did the short stories. I did the plays. Mm-hmm. I did the poems. Sometimes they've come out in books. Sometimes they haven't. That doesn't matter. The point is I did them. Mm. I've never done a novel. And the reason I never did a novel was because I got told off for trying once.
Really? Who was that?
Commissioned to write one, and I had a go at a draft and sent it in, and the commissioning editor said, David, you don't know how to write a novel. I said, why not? And they said, because you don't describe your characters. I said, what do you want to describe the characters for? I mean, you know, it's how they talk to each other is the thing. No, said the fella, I need to know how your characters look. And I said, can't you just tell? I mean, you see, I got confused. I'd been writing plays where you don't have to say what the characters look like, because the actor does that for you. If you're making a film script, you don't have to say except perhaps as part of a brief, because the actors will do it. But in a novel, you have to say, and I wasn't very good at this. I had a go at it, and it was awful. And that was years ago, and I thought, I'm never going to be a novelist. So this time, I'm going to have another go. And actually, it isn't a novel so much as a novella, in that it's quite short. But it's essentially a spy thriller. Mm. It's called The Encyclopedia Codes. I call it a pseudo-autobiographical novella because it's based on real-life experiences that I had here in this very room when we were editing the Cambridge Encyclopedia, the general encyclopedia, not the language ones, back in the 1980s. And it's based on that. The thought might be that people use the encyclopedia to spy, and what would happen if they did. And so I developed a scenario where that actually happened. And as a result of this, the first line of the novella reads, I was responsible for the breakup of the Soviet Union because of the way things developed. And I'm rather proud of that. But did it happen? Well, you have to buy the book and find out.
And there was me about to ask you which part of that was true. You were responsible for the
break. That's the thing you're going to have to decide for yourself once you see it.
Now, can you give us any more? Can you give us any more at all, or do we have to wait for the book? Because there, I'm curious.
No, it's out already. This is the amazing thing. No publisher is going to be interested in David Crystal writing a novel. Come on, I'm not in that world, you know. And publishers only want bestsellers. Mm-hmm. So I knew that if I approached a conventional publisher, they just wouldn't be interested. So for the first time, I've explored Kindle Direct Publishing and Amazon Paperback Direct Publishing. And I have to say, it is amazing. I finished this book 3 weeks ago. We're talking in the last week of July. Hillary and I, my wife, who's also a book designer and so on, and things like that, she designed the cover. We uploaded it to Kindle and then to Amazon 2 weeks ago. It came out 3 days later and is on the Amazon site right now. And people have been buying it, and I haven't had a copy yet, but people who have bought this have sent me pictures holding it up.
Yeah.
You know, from submitting the manuscript to having a book copy in your hand within 3 days, it's unbelievable.
They printed it that quickly.
The quality is excellent, you know. So I have avoided, Amazon Publishing because I've never had a need to go there. But when you come across, when you're doing something and you know it's not going to interest mainstream publishing, I've made a discovery here, and I have to say I'm terribly, terribly impressed. So it's out. I can't show it to you because I haven't had a copy through myself yet. I've ordered one.
I'm curious, though. I don't know if you're going to be willing to share it with us, but isn't there an anecdote that the book I've seen on Amazon, you know, you have the look inside option, and I can see the first few pages, and you start by telling an anecdote about a time when you were going to be a guest speaker at an event. And that seems to be when it all kicked off. But I'm intrigued. Obviously, that's the point. But how much of this anecdote can you share with us? How much can you tell us before we actually get the book? Mm.
Well, you can read that if you go type David Crystal Encyclopedia Codes into Amazon. You can go there and you can look inside the book and you'll see the first few pages indeed, because I checked it out because I'd never done this before and I wanted to see what happened. And indeed, it was when we were sending the first edition of the big encyclopedia. Huge thing. I'll show you. Hold on a second. Mm-hmm. Well, this big thing, you see.
Yeah, the Cambridge Encyclopedia.
Huge book, the Cambridge Encyclopedia. And we were editing it for the first time, putting it together for the first time in 1989. Mm. So the project, remember, I left the university in 84, got this job as editor in 86, and the first volume was coming out in 1989 So we were putting this thing to bed. And 1989 is not a good year to be writing an encyclopedia because everything is changing. The Berlin Wall is coming down. You know,
yeah.
Soviet Union is shortly going to break up into pieces.
Thanks to you. So
everything is happening all over the world. And we're trying to put it into an encyclopedia. So the first edition comes out in 89, the second corrected, updated edition in 1990, another one in 1991. And I was asked to give a lecture to the Royal Institution in London, where they have a thing called a Friday evening lecture.
What's
and that? They invite people in to talk about whatever, science, technology, in my case, encyclopedia writing. So I told them some of the stories about how it is that you try and keep an encyclopedia up to date, and it's very difficult because people aren't talking about it. When the Soviet Union was about to break up, and we didn't know if it was, I had a deadline. So I would ring up the embassies and say, excuse me, Soviet Union, are you going to break up in the next few days? And they would say, who are you? You know, you know, why do you want to know? No, all is well. There is to be no breakup of Soviet Union and all this, you see. So we would do this. We always check with the embassies and things of that kind. I ring up the Foreign Office and they say the same thing. You know, no, dear boy, you know, the Soviet Union is not going to break up in the next. No, 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 don't worry about it. You can put it in your encyclopedia. All of this is going on. But then I hear, just as we're going to press, the news that there is going to be, in place of the Soviet Union, a Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS. And I do some digging and some inquiring and find out that, yes, indeed, this is likely to happen. It's not necessarily going to happen, but it is likely to happen. Which countries are going to be in there? I find out as much as I can about it. Now, the question is, I have to send my copy off to the publisher next Monday. The book will come out in 6 months' time, by which time will there or won't there be a Commonwealth of Independent States? If I put it in and there isn't, the book will be laughed at. If I don't put it in and there is, the book will be laughed at. What do I do? So I decide to write an entry on the Commonwealth of Independent States. This is all fact. This happened.
Yeah.
And you know, Kingdom, Commonwealth of Independent States, and I put it in, and off it goes to Cambridge. Fingers crossed. Eventually, of course, there is. But at that time, we did not know.
So you had to make a prediction, pretty much.
I had to make a prediction.
Place a bet sort of thing.
I had to basically say the Soviet Union is going to disappear and the Commonwealth of Independent States will appear because it says so in the encyclopedia. Right? Now, that's what happened. So then I started to think, in terms of the novella, hey, the encyclopedia manuscript arrives in Cambridge, where there is a mole. And the Cambridge guy thinks, what does Crystal know? He's obviously got an insight into something that's going on here. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in Cambridge Encyclopedia. He knows something about what's happening. I'd better get in touch with all the nations around that are not wanting the Soviet Union to fragment and let them know that Crystal is onto us. And that's where the novel starts.
Ah, so then they come after you in some manner, I suppose.
They most certainly do.
Wow. Great.
And there is a chase and there is a gunfight and there is all sorts of things happen. It's great fun.
This
great.
sounds so entertaining. I'm going to look forward to reading it. It's really good. I want to ask you some other things before I let you go. That's one of those things that people say, isn't it, at the end of a conversation. I'll let you go now. Yeah. Before I let you go. I mean, I'm sort of really interested in jokes and in humour. And stuff on my podcast. I often do stuff about that. I do stand up myself. And I was thinking, have you ever written about jokes in English? Have you written about the place of humour in the language? I'm also curious to know if, and this is a This is one of those terrible questions which contains lots of questions all at the same time, because I can't be brief for some reason. I'm also curious to see if you've ever considered doing comedy because of the kind of humour that I notice in your work and because of the way that you observe things. Sometimes I think that you would look at the world in the same way that a stand-up comedian would look at the world, observing it and then sort of telling us what you've observed. Yours is from the point of view of linguistics and telling people how language works and you know, observing and pointing out things. The comedian kind of does the same thing but presents it for laughs. But anyway, what is my question?
Well, no, I mean, you've made the point.
Yeah.
And the point and the response is, I would be horrified if I gave a lecture and it did not have some laughs in it.
Hmm.
Consciously controlled laughs, I mean, not inadvertent ones.
Yes. Yeah.
I always try to build humour into the lecture, even if it's on the most serious of topics. And if it's not humour in the sense of satirical humour, it's, as it were, sympathetic humour. Because you can tell stories that make people laugh, even about the most serious of subjects, like language death, for instance. There are some lovely, funny stories about that arise out of the horrible situation of a language dying. And there's no reason why you shouldn't reflect the reality of the communities from which these stories come, so long as the overall message retains its impact and its seriousness and so on. But most of the talks that I give are not that serious in that sense, and it's dead easy to introduce an element of humour. If you're talking about accents, for instance, and dialects or prescriptivism or grammar, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I mean, a lecture on grammar without a few jokes in it is a disaster in my mind. And I think many teachers would feel exactly the same thing. So I don't see that much difference, indeed, between being a stand-up and being a lecturer. Lecturers are stand-ups, after all, for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Just a
but when it comes to analysing humour in this kind of way, I have done a bit of that. There are some sections in the Cambridge Encyclopedia of the English Language which are basically on the language of humour, language of jokes and things of that kind. I never ever researched it myself very much, except in the context of language acquisition, child language acquisition, where the interesting research question was, when do children first start telling jokes, as it were, and what sort of jokes do they tell, and what are the linguistic issues that will prevent a child from appreciating the source of a joke? So any of you out there who have got children in the 5-year to 7-year-old range will have had this experience, especially if there are older children in the family. The older child comes in, for example, and tells a joke, or is watching the television and laughs at a joke, and the younger child says, why was that funny? What was that? What's funny about that? And the older kid gets cross because, don't be silly. Of course it was funny, you know, and the little row breaks out. Because between 5 and 7, there is a very important development. The notion of a riddle is one that is opaque to 5-year-olds. 7-year-olds are starting to understand what riddles are and how they play with words and how there are two meanings and puns, things like that. 5-year-olds, on the whole, find puns impossible to interpret. 7-year-olds are beginning to interpret them fine. So that's the kind of developmental thing that one looks at and explores and sees what sort of things going on. So I've looked at that, but there are some people who are specialised in this, of course.
Yeah, yeah. What about jokes? I suppose if you haven't looked at it yet, I don't know if you're able to comment on it really, but what's the point of jokes? What do you think about that?
Well, it's part of a bigger issue. What is the function of language? Now, look language up in a dictionary and it will say the function of language is to communicate ideas. Fine. All right. There's a lot of that. That's what we're doing now. That misses out a second function of language, which is to express identity, which is what accents and dialects are all about. That misses out on the third primary function of language, which is to have fun, to enjoy it, for itself, and humour is part of that. Now, this is, in a sense, the most important function of language because it is the very first. From the moment a child is born, it encounters language play. I wrote a whole book at once called Language Play. You can see it. It's available on my website.
Yeah.
And that starts at birth, because when a baby is born, the baby doesn't come into a world of second language teaching. You know, hello, baby. You are a baby. This is your mother. That is a wall. You are in a hospital. This is a doctor. And that is a nurse. That is not what you get when you're just born.
Unless you're my daughter, in which case it's the case. That's a wall. Anyway.
Yeah, no, later on, second year language, darling, don't touch that plug. That's dangerous. That's the hot tap. Don't touch the hot tap. That's second year parent-child language. No, first year parent-child language goes something like this. Oh, you lovely little baba. You are the gorgeous baba. Yes, you are. You are. You are gorgeous. And so on and so forth. And when you analyze parent-child language in the first year of life, what you find is that most of it is playful. Not explicitly baby talk like that, but baby talk elements come in all the time. And the aim is to have the child enjoy the language encounter, the language experience.
Mm.
And it goes all the way through the first year of life and then diminishes as the second year teaching language comes in, but it's always there. So when people have been studying the language of humor, what they notice is that what children laugh at or don't laugh at is always underpinning the actual language acquisition that expresses ideas and identity and all the rest of it. I've got a recording here of two three-year-olds playing together, two three-year-old girls, and they've got little animals, and one is saying, mine's got wings, yours hasn't, and the other says, no, mine's got no wingos. And the other one says, no wingos and dringos and zingos and dingos. And the other one says, the wingy woes and dingy woes. And they're all having a great time. They're not laughing at each other, but they are enjoying the humour of language play. And this is always there. And you and I do the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, if neither of us were stand-ups, as it were, nonetheless, when we're having a conversation, and in the book I talk a lot about this, people are always playing with language, putting on silly voices, you know, adopting a strange accent to make a joke or whatever it might be.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're all humorists, really.
So it's a third important underlying principle of language.
I think so. I think humor is a part of this.
Yeah.
Everybody enjoys language play or plays with language for themselves. Now, some of the listeners and viewers here might say, but I'm sorry, David, I don't make silly voices. I don't adopt silly accents and things like that. So what are you going to say to that? Well, in return, I say, but you play with language in a different way then. Do you do crossword puzzles? Do you play Scrabble? And suddenly you realize these are ways of playing with language as well, for enjoying language play. And they can generate laughs, or they may not, but it's the enjoyment is the thing. And that's why you tell the joke. Not necessarily to get a laugh, although it's nice if it happens, but that people enjoy the encounter they've had with you and go away thinking, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if, you know, you're not a teacher per se, but... a language teacher, but I wonder if sort of adding humour, looking at jokes in the language learning classroom or language learning scenario is a good move. I'm always wondering this because I feel compelled to do it. I'm not sure why, but probably because I just enjoy it. But I wonder if it is useful to incorporate jokes and humour into the language learning environment.
Well, I think it is if jokes and humour are part of the environment of the language that the person is learning. Now, I suppose all cultures have some sort of jokey, humorous element, but some more than others, and some don't let it come to the surface so much. So it would depend on the language, I think, depend on the culture. But in our culture, it is a very important feature, as I've tried to explain in the language acquisition context.
Yeah.
And what I would say is that it's a bit like child language acquisition, second language learning, isn't it? And some, of course, people in your world have tried to draw a specific parallel between first language and second language acquisition. Yeah. Well, just in the same way as a seven-year-old can't use his humor, uses jokes, which a five-year-old can't understand, I imagine, analogously, there would be certain types of jokes which a learner who had reached a certain level would not be able to understand simply because the language is too complicated for that sort of access. Mm. So one of the things I would do if I was researching this in your world, and I suppose some people have, is I'd take all the jokes and all the riddles and everything, and I'd grade them. You know, a syllabus of humor on which jokes are going to be easy to understand and which jokes are going to be more difficult for whatever reason. It might be to do with the vocabulary, might do with the grammatical construction, might be an intonational contrast. It might be a pun based on pronunciation. It might be a spelling joke, after all. It could be any of these things. And some are going to be easy and some are going to be hard, and there's going to be a spectrum. I don't know whether anybody's done this, but it'd be nice if they did.
There was a study, I'm not sure how serious it was on various levels. There was a study done by Richard Wiseman. I don't know if you're familiar with him. They did a study called Laugh Lab, where they asked people to contribute jokes. And this was on the internet. It was across, you know, various cultures from different countries. People contributed jokes in English. And then the jokes were graded and so on and voted on. And the one that received the most votes it was interesting because there was no pun involved in it. Not really. There wasn't really a homophone or anything like that in there. It didn't have any specific cultural references. And that seemed to be the one that, you know, the center of the Venn diagram was the one that everyone was able to get, basically.
Yeah, everybody was able to relate to it. Yeah. Oh, that's lovely if you can find some examples like that. But the vast majority, of course, are not going to be like that. That, as it were, is the easy case.
Yeah.
The tricky ones are the ones where there is some cultural or linguistic element. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. A difficult one, because the word that is the point of the joke is difficult.
Yeah.
It's in every seven-year-old book of jokes. When is a door not a door? Answer, when it's ajar.
Right.
Now, because the word ajar, A-J-A-R, is not in any list of the most frequently occurring words in English, very few foreign learners would know that word. And so the joke would go over their heads, as indeed it goes over the heads of any seven-year-old. Even, you know, that's a joke that perhaps a 10-year-old might get or something of that sort. So that's what I mean. If you look at the words, this is one way of grading in vocabulary. You take the frequency lists and all the things that are routine in the second language world, and you look at the jokes. That's one corpus. You've got the jokes in another corpus. And then you see, well, where does a jar fit? Oh, it's down there. That's really advanced. Mm. Whereas another joke uses easy puns, and that's up there. You could do the same sort of thing for grammar, pronunciation, and so on, I imagine.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. I just have two more things to ask you before I let you go. One of the questions I often get from my listeners is about the subject of raising bilingual kids. I just thought I'd, you know, see what you had to say about this. So I'm going to try and boil it down as much as I can. The issue is, should the parents speak English to their kids, even if the parents don't have English as a first language? So let's say the parents are living in a country where English isn't the first language. Neither of the parents speak English as a first language. Maybe they're intermediate, upper intermediate, or something like that, and they want their child to grow up, you know, speaking English. Should the parents speak English to the child, even if they aren't proficient in English?
The most important principle in all multilingualism with acquisition is be natural. The home is a natural place. If the parent, in one scenario, one parent speaks one language, the other parent speaks the other language, question that arises, which language should we use? Answer, use both. If it's natural to use both. If there is one language for the home, use that. If there are two languages in the home and the kid is encountering these two languages, not just between parents, but with grandparents around or people who help in the house or whatever it might be, or out in the street, expose, let the child develop. Remember, from the point of view of the child, the child doesn't, the young child we're talking about now, up to the age of about 3 and a half.
Okay.
The child does not know they are different languages. All the child knows is that dad speaks one way, mum speaks another way, and now she's speaking in another way again. Well, I mean, oh, that's life. That's fine, you know? And the kid doesn't know that there's a pronunciation problem in the English that's being used by the mother or by the father or what have you, if there is, or if there's a grammatical error, you know? Pretty precocious two-year-old to say, oh, father, you know, that... preposition is, you know. No, only in the fourth year of life do children realize that there are such things as different languages. They start to name those languages and start to trade one language off against the other. There are many studies on this now. This sort of scenario where it's bedtime, French-speaking mother, German-speaking father. German-speaking father comes up to the kid and says in German, it's bedtime. And the kid says in French, I don't speak German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see, that kind of kid realizes that there are two languages, tries to trade one off against the other for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So it's fourth year of life, that. Before that, everything is up for grabs. The kid is amazing. I mean, this is the thing about young children, that they have this immensely flexible language learning device, as it used to be called, perhaps still is in some places. They just assimilate whatever is around them. They mix them up, of course. Well, that's natural as well. There's nothing wrong with that. They'll sort it all out eventually, especially beginning in the fourth year, and realize, oh, those things go with the French thing I'm called, and those things go with the German thing that it's called, and so on. Oh, I see. And those things go with the English thing that it's called. So, first of all, I wouldn't worry. Mm-hmm. Be natural. Second point, the situation you outline is very, very common around the world, extremely common, because of the incidence of multicultural language, multicultural marriages or partnerships or whatever you call them these days. So I'm now thinking of a scenario that I encountered in the Emirates, where I met a German industrialist, an oil man, who had met and married a lady from Malaysia. Mm-hmm. He spoke German. She spoke Malay. The only language they had in common was second language English.
Mm-hmm.
And they spoke respectively, because I heard them both, in a very, you know, non-British American kind of way.
Yeah.
The Malay lady had a very syllable timed rhythm, for instance. The German guy couldn't say TH to save his life, you know, that sort of thing.
To save his life. Yeah.
They are chattering quite happily away to each other. This is the language of the home.
Yeah.
And the kid is now growing up learning English as a second language, as its mother tongue.
Wow.
You see, because it hears no other English. What kind of English is that going to be? Well, it's going to be a very different kind of variety from what you'd expect in a monolingual native speaker type of situation. Now, that kid is not alone, because that kid goes to a creche where everybody else is in the same boat. Well, not everybody, but, you know, there are lots of other kids who are also being brought up in English by parents where English is not the first language. Now, I have no idea how many kids in the world are in this position, but we are talking a lot.
Yeah.
And so I would love to see a study of a kid who begins that way, or kids who begin that way. And in five, how are they, what are they in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time? When they get to school and they start to learn standard English and all the things that they'll learn there, to what extent will their native command of the English be the same as the standard English they're now encountering? Will it be different? Yeah, it's a lovely research domain here. Mm. And again, I don't know of anything written on it, but then I'm not a specialist in that. So there may be something there.
I wonder, just speculating about it, I can imagine that it would be easier for that child who's been learning English as a second language from their parents who speak it as a second language, that it would be easier for them to make the transition to this standard English that they would be exposed to later than it would be if they had no exposure to English at all. Mm. So, because, you know, people, I guess the question is it worth talking to my child in English when my English is not quote unquote perfect or quote unquote native or not like yours, Luke, or whatever it is?
My answer to that would be yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Because even though there may be some, in inverted commas, errors that translate, that transmit, an awful lot of the time, the vocabulary, for instance, and so on, is probably likely to be pretty accurate, you know, and the pronunciation is not going to be too far away. And in any case, we mustn't just talk about parents here, because these days, how do you avoid English? As you go out into the streets or watch the television or listen to pop music or go onto the internet and so on. Now, I know we're talking here mainly about slightly older children, but I've come across kids who are fluent in internet speak, as it were, or video games and things of this kind, and they're picking up all kinds of English from all over the place. And you know, there is more instinctive awareness of English around than I think we sometimes give credit for.
Okay, so I guess for that listener or those listeners who've asked me that question, the answer would be yes, go ahead.
Well, absolutely. Yep. I mean, you know, it happens all the time. We have to hear in Wales, only now we're talking about Welsh, where somebody is not a very good Welsh speaker, but nonetheless wants the kid to have some experience of Welsh. So they introduce as much Welsh into their everyday life as they possibly can. When they're going down the street and they see a Welsh sign, they articulate it to the child and things like that. So the kid is on a career track towards Welshness, even though the parents are only going to help them a little way along that road.
Yeah, a little way is better than nothing.
Absolutely, in my view.
Final question, and I sort of have my reservations about asking this to you, mainly because it's based on a conversation I had with my brother at the weekend. I talked to you earlier about how people find certain things in language to be annoying. I just wanted to see what you think about this. I hope he doesn't. I hope he doesn't mind me asking you this. I did say I think I better ask David Crystal about this, and he was like, So we'll see how he feels about me asking you this. So, yes, we were talking about something that irritates him. Okay, so here's the situation. He's in a shop, okay, and he's paying for his shopping. He wants to pay by card. He ends up saying, "Can I pay by card?" And the shop assistant says, "Of course," in a way that suggests that it's obvious that he can pay by card, or that he didn't really need to ask for permission to pay by card. But my brother finds it annoying that the person goes, "Yeah, of course." So I said to him, "Well, you know, you did just say, 'Can I pay by card?'" And his problem is that he can't think of an alternative to "Can I pay by card?" He doesn't want to say, "I'm going to pay by card," because as far as he's concerned, that is too direct and makes him sound a bit arrogant. So we weren't able to conclude the conversation. And I just want to know what you think about this. I don't know if you've got an answer to this, but what do you think about this situation? Can I pay by card? Yeah, of course.
Is less ambiguous in many ways. We're talking here about a classic ambiguity in modal auxiliaries.
Yeah.
And can is famous for its two meanings, can in the sense of be able to and can in the sense of permission. And I don't know whether how many of our listeners and viewers will ever have had the experience of being in a primary school where the kid says, "Can I go to the toilet?" And the teacher says, "David, may I go to the toilet?" And they attempt to get the child to replace the word "can" with the word "may." And this is a classic politeness strategy, which sometimes has worked and sometimes hasn't, because can retains its ambiguity. So whenever you say can about something, there is always a context usually resolves this, of course, perfectly clearly. But the ambiguity is always there. Can I ride my bike? Well, I don't know. Have you learnt to ride? I mean, this could be the basis of a good joke, you see, you stand-up guy, where the person deliberately takes the other meaning out of the situation.
Right.
So the person who is responding in the supermarket is taking one meaning out of it, whereas the speaker is presenting a different meaning, don't you think? And the only way out of this is to avoid the auxiliary altogether, go for the conditional form, which is less ambiguous, you know, could I pay by card, which is less ambiguous than can I pay by card.
Or,
you know, use a different construction if it's really irritating. I mean, isn't that the principle? If you find something irritating, you avoid it.
I suppose so. I just thought maybe he should just say card okay. I think that's probably what he needs to say. Yeah. Lift the card and go card okay. That's probably good. Yeah. That's probably it.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a strategy that I did come across once, a jokey classroom session where I was observing, not giving it, where the people were getting real problems with tag questions and how a tag question should relate in auxiliary verbs. You know, I'm going, aren't I? You're going, aren't you? She's going, isn't she? Yeah. And so on and so forth. Now, in real trouble with this.
Yeah.
So in the end, the teacher says, all you've got to do is go to say, in it, at the end. I'm going, in it. You're going, in it. She's going, in it. Well, it's all the problems, all the problems. Or if you don't want in it, you know, just I'm going, eh? You're going, eh? She's going, eh? So maybe this is a situation where you avoid it. And
yeah. I think breaking down the sentence to the absolute bare minimum is probably okay in this scenario.
Well, the less you say, the less you're likely to be misinterpreted. The ancient tradition sort of goes against the principle of language teaching somehow, though.
Yes, I think so. Well, David, thank you so much for talking to me and my audience again on my podcast. It's been a pleasure. And I look forward to uncovering the mystery of the encyclopedia codes.
I hope you enjoy it. I hope people enjoy them, these books indeed. And well, thank you for your interest and hope people have enjoyed this conversation too.
Me too.
Thank you.
So that was David Crystal, and it is a treat to have him on the podcast. I feel very lucky to have been able to talk to him, although he is very friendly, very approachable, I find. So maybe, you know, in another 2 years or however long it's been, I'll get in touch with him again for another conversation, or maybe sooner than that. What else do I need to say? His books, right? He's a very prolific writer, as I've said. He's written over 100 books. Some of his work is academic in style, but a lot of his work is very accessible for like non-linguists, just normal people. His books are very entertaining and easy to read, and I definitely recommend reading some of his work. It's possible to learn a lot of English from it and also learn a lot about English from it too. So check out his books, and if you want a list of recommended books, then just check the page for this episode on my website. And you can have a look at those things there, okay? Thanks again to David for being on the podcast today. That's it, really. Check the website. Oh, yeah, there's a video version of this conversation. I forgot to mention that at the beginning. There is a video version of this episode, which you can find on YouTube. It doesn't have any introduction, just goes straight into the conversation. But anyway, if you'd like to see us talking as well as listen to us, you could check out that video on YouTube, and you can see David Crystal's wonderful white bushy beard, which is always a joy to behold. Yes. Okay, then. Right now, what's going on? So this is episode 676. I'm actually recording this quite late in the evening. It's nearly time for me to go to bed. But this is probably going to be the last episode I publish before going on holiday, just because, as I said in the last episode, it's been a mad race against time. I was supposed to go back to Paris a couple of days ago, but my flight was cancelled due to, you know, the COVID situation. Not enough people had booked themselves onto the flight, and so Air France just cancelled it. I didn't know. They had sent me an email, which went straight to my spam folder, so I didn't read it. So I turned up at the airport with my daughter, expecting to get a flight, and the staff at the airport were like, "Flight? What flight? Aeroplane? What do you mean? Never heard of an aeroplane around here, have we, Simon? No, aeroplane? No, what's that?" So none of them knew anything about my flight. Turns out Air France had cancelled it like 2 weeks earlier. And they had, you know, to be fair, they had put me onto another flight, but I'd missed that one. So anyway, it was really annoying. So I've been, I wouldn't say stuck here, although technically I have, because otherwise I'd be going home. But I've been forced to stay in the comfortable and loving surroundings of my mum and dad's house, which is where I'm recording this. What's the point, Luke? What is the point? That's a good question. Generally, what is the point? I'll let you answer that question. But anyway, what I'm saying is that it's been a mad race against time. So I haven't been able to produce and upload all the episodes I'd hoped I would be able to produce and upload. So in terms of the free podcast, this is going to be it until the end of August, when I'll be back from holiday, from the holiday. But premium subscribers, I'm going to be working super hard in the, well, I've basically got one day of work ahead of me. That will be Sunday. I know I'm supposed to take, you're supposed to take Sunday off, aren't you? Anyway, I'll be working. Monday is the day we set off on holiday, but Sunday will be my chance to record and upload as much premium content as I possibly can. So premium subscribers, all, if all goes according to plan, then you'll get loads of premium stuff arriving on Sunday. I've got a series I mentioned before about homophones, words that sound the same, even though they're spelt differently and they have different meanings. But I've got a big series on homophones, which will cover all of the most common homophones in English, which should be really useful in terms of, well, vocab. You're bound to learn some vocab from it. And also, in terms of your spelling, just hopefully you'll realize, that word is spelt like that, is it? And maybe pronunciation too. You might think, you pronounce it like that, do you? So that's the idea. And I've got a huge list of homophones and loads of jokes as well. So, because homophones often occur in jokes, as I said before in the previous episode. So anyway, this episode, for the free subscribers, it's just this episode until the end of August, but for premium people there will be premium stuff coming on Sunday, which you will be able to, like, you know, feed on until I upload some more. Okay, all right then. Good. I hope you're doing all right. I'm taking the train tomorrow, two trains with my daughter. Forget about planes. It's too complicated, too unreliable in the current climate. It's a bit of a weird time, as we all know, but certainly this weekend decided to take the Eurostar. So I'm going to have to take a train to London and then another train from London to Paris and keep checking the news headlines. I keep expecting Boris Johnson to impose more lockdown restrictions because the number of COVID infections is going up again. So I'm kind of thinking, oh God, I hope I can get out in time before they close the border or something. Anyway, it's a bit like that film 2012 with John Cusack. Is it Cusack or Cusack? I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Cusack, I think. Like that film 2012 with John Cusack, which is a sort of disaster film set in 2012. It's like that, but it's 2020 and I'm Luke, not John Cusack. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. Because there's a scene where he has to escape from a city which is kind of crumbling. because of an earthquake. Okay, it's not the same at all. There's no earthquake, and I'm not in a city. But anyway, it feels like a sort of dramatic escape. That's what I'm trying to say. Although it's very nice to be here. You're rambling, Luke. I am rambling. But anyway, it's been very nice to talk to you. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation with David Crystal. And I'll be back to talk to you again at the end of the month. I hope you have a nice August. And I'll speak to you later. Okay, everyone. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Bye. 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 Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.